looking at myself and thinking, unlike music, where I felt some real barriers, where I felt limitations, I felt like no one would hold me back with writing, which is kind of a weird thing to say. But I never, like, I'd cry for a day and I'd get right back up and write the next thing. I was not defeated by it. And that seems so important and so meaningful that I just kept going. Nothing stopped me, and that I did recognize the significance of that.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Martha Ann Toll is a novelist and literary and cultural critic, also a violist, whose classical music training informs her artistic practice. She comes to writing professionally after a career dedicated to social justice. She recently published her second novel about musicians, Duet for One, and we focused on both this book and her novel Three Muses. You'll hear about her high and low points as a violist, different ways she's helped with programs related to social justice, and her involvement in the literary world, including supporting less represented authors. We also talked about processing grief, the classical music world, including patterns of different types of abuse, and living true to your values. Linked in the show notes on my website, you'll find Martha's playlist of music related to Duet for One, a list of books by other authors that Martha recommends, and other episodes of this podcast you'll enjoy. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel, listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, or read the transcript. Everything linked to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find timestamps and all the links, including different ways to support this podcast. Hi, Martha. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Hi, I am so happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, this is the first time I have interviewed a novelist on this series, and you are an unusual guest. I have to say, it took me a bit of time to decide if it would be right for my listeners, but I decided in the end for sure. We will be talking about your new novel, Duet for One. Thanks for sending me a preview copy so I was able to read it early. I really enjoyed it, and we'll talk about your other novel and your very full life.
Thank you.
So what's unusual, I have had musicians on the series who maybe don't earn their primary income from music, but it's unusual that I've never had someone that didn't pursue music as their main path. So that's where you differ. And so let's talk about your early life as a violist and what that was like.
Thank you. And I appreciate your going off the beaten track here, because I have trouble sometimes explaining this myself. I started viola in public school in suburban Philadelphia, where I grew up. My mother, there are four girls in my family. I'm the third. My mother really wanted a string quartet. That's really how it started. So we already had a cellist and a violinist. So I started on viola in public school. My parents were very interested in music, not musicians themselves, but they always got us good teachers. And I had very, very good private teachers in addition to public school. And our public school system had a very good network of orchestras and community orchestras and county orchestras. And my life really changed when I was 14 years old and I started studying with Max Aronoff, who was in the founding class at Curtis Institute of Music, founder of the Curtis String Quartet, and still the best violist I've ever heard. And he was someone with, like a grandfather figure, with an incredible gift to the gab, an extraordinary disciplinarian, but unlike two huge differences from other teachers. One is all of our lessons were about how to practice. And so he could deconstruct the music. And two, he was very, very supportive while still being strict. And you and I both probably have an encyclopedia of musicians who have been damaged by teachers who didn't know how to criticize.
Yes. And this is a theme that comes up in this book, you know.
Yes.
And I really felt reading it right away, well, no one could have written this if they really didn't know the classical music world.
We make beautiful music, but there's a lot of hardship behind the scenes, right? So
there can be, yeah.
Yeah.
So you did pursue a BA in music at Yale.
Yes. So Max, so So what Max was doing for me was putting a sound in my ear that was just extraordinary. He had an extraordinary instrument, but it wasn't that. It was his ability to produce that fat viola sound. But I did not want to go to conservatory. He would have preferred that I do that. But I'm, you know, I don't know, really strong. I had really, really strong academic interests. I was always a fanatic reader. I grew up in a house full of books. And so I majored in music at Yale. And the beginning was really fantastic. I mean, I got a rotating first chair in the symphony. And the Yale Symphony was made up of people who became professional musicians in orchestras all over the United States and also Europe. I don't know about Canada, but I do know about Europe. And basically, over time, and some of this book is autobiographical, I realized that words were more accessible to me than music. And so I opted not to go into a music career. And there was a lot of pain associated with that. And it took me, this is a very long story short, but how did I write a novel? It took me decades to figure out a way to describe this experience in a way that wasn't totally negative for me, the transition and the sort of transition to being a writer and having a different career than I anticipated as a younger person.
So in terms of the autobiographical aspects, the very negative teacher who's pictured in that book, did you have an experience similar to that?
Yes. And I had been commuting. So New Haven, where Yale is about 4 or 5 hour train trip from Philadelphia. I had been commuting back to Philadelphia every 2 weeks, I'm sorry, to take a 2 hour lesson with Max. And I tried to study with somebody on campus. And this was a viola teacher. I'm going to name him. He's dead. There's no problem in naming. His name is Raphael Hilliard. He's a very, very renowned violist. And he had spent some time in the Juilliard String Quartet. And he had been coaching me for my entire freshman year. He absolutely loved my playing. And then when I went to play for him as an individual student, he was extremely destructive. And this is always hard for a young person to navigate. It turned out this was a pattern that he did with his female students. He was well known. I didn't know that at the time. But just to finish that thought, it was providential probably because I am a total word person and I never have regretted the decision, but music is so important and I always wanted, and such what Max Aronoff is such an important mentor to me. I've always wanted to bring it together. So that's what this book is for me personally. I hope it doesn't read that way for the reader. It's a love story. I mean, it's a different kind of a story for the reader, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you deal with so many important things like grief. Mm-hmm. Starts with a death. I can say that right away because if anyone yes. opens it up. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the other impetus for this book, which was kind of like a lightning bolt, I opened this is in an author's note at the end of the book. I opened the paper one day to see that Lillian Kallir had died. Lillian Kallir was a beautiful Czech emigre to Philadelphia. And I had heard her play, and she was married to Claude Frank, also a very famous pianist. And my first thought when I saw that she had died was, what happens to Claude Frank? I mean, he had a solo career, but what happens to their musical partnership? And that is the germ of this book. When the spouse of a famous two-piano team pianist, when their spouse dies, it's not just a loss of a spouse, it's a loss of a career. So that is a problem on page one of this book. And the other thing that's on page one is their son, Adam, who's a professional violinist in his late 30s, is looking at his mother totally differently. He sees her as someone who was absent from his life, whereas his father sees his whole musical career being lost. It's two divergent views of the same woman. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I like the way you use the different points of view of the narrator in both your books.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, you mentioned your parents briefly. Your mother was an editor and poet.
She wrote doggerel. She loved doing that. She was a copy editor and she was freelance. So in those days, she definitely had a career, but us school kids weren't always so tuned into it because she worked at the dining room table. So we always ate in the kitchen, the dining room table, you know, galley proofs for books were always in paper and there would be rolls. There were long rolls of rolls all over the dining room table along with the laundry. So She works school hours, and I am ashamed to admit, but I think many of us daughters took some time to realize this. She was working the whole time we were in school. We were, but she was completely available after school. So it took me some years into maturity to realize how she actually pulled that off. And she was a fanatic reader also.
And your dad was a lawyer and author.
Yes, my dad was obsessed with the written word, and dinner was a lot of you had to memorize poetry, you had the dictionary was next to the table, the encyclopedia was next to the table. I mean, it was words were the currency of the household, no question. So I feel very, very lucky. I have no formal education in writing, but really got it at the dining room table, I think.
And later in this conversation, I do want to get into your work as a lawyer and social justice. It's so important. But since we're talking about your writing life, I mean, you were also a literary critic for many years and reading 100 books a year.
I think you will appreciate this as a musician. It's never about the quantity, it's always about the quality. But I do read a lot, and that's always been my MO from the time I learned to read. I had, like many, many writers, and again, I don't know quite what it's like in Canada, but in the United States, it's very, very hard to get a novel published. So I had a very typical experience in that it took me 20 years to get a novel published. It's not that unusual. And during that time, I realized, I'm reading all these books. I would love to share what I'm reading. So starting in around 2010, I became a book critic. And that is still something that I do. Very satisfying because it was a way to get published and to share my passion for what I was reading. And I also am mission driven to review books that are by authors of color, by independent presses, by women who get less attention from the mainstream press and the mainstream outlets.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this 20-year gestation, because it wasn't just trying to get published. I understand this particular book, Duet for One, there must have been different versions. Maybe you lived with these characters for so long. I found it interesting that the minor characters did show different aspects of a musical career in classical music.
The book changed a lot. As I said, I went back and checked when I was writing the afterword for my book. So Lillian Collier died in 2004, which must be when I started this book. And I was in usually in the States, you sell a book via a literary agent, and I got a literary agent for this book right away. And then that person could not sell the book. So then I wrote several more novels, and was really excited to have Three Muses published, but that was 18 years later. So Duet for One, which is the book we're talking about music, I basically, I don't know, it was like a child. I had to like go back to it every year and revise it. And the initial names, you'll just be amused, were of the two pianists were Lawrence and Francis Cates, and there were too many apostrophes, like the S apostrophe didn't work. So I changed their names, and occasionally I make a mistake. Like in early drafts, it's like, what is Lawrence doing here? Their names are Victor and Adele Pearl, which got rid of my S apostrophe problem. So their characters didn't change. I had to change their names, but minor characters changed. And a lot of characters, I added a lot of additional characters. And over time, Adam became the center of the novel. The early drafts of the novel were written in the shadow of my own mother's death. And my father lived for 20 years after her. I was extremely engaged with my father's grief and how he was handling it. So in the early days, I was more focused on Victor, who is the husband of the pianist who's died. But over time, I realized Adam's the star of the show, and I should pump him up a little bit. So that's one way in which it changed. And the other way is the acceptance as I've gotten older, and I do think it's a characteristic of aging, is to accept more complexity. There are a lot of things that can't be answered in this book. And as we get older, we realize there's a lot of conflicts and inconsistencies that are true at the same time.
Yeah. And you've talked, in social media too, I think addressing a younger audience, that your parents had lives before you were around.
And there was, so I have an unpublished novel that I wish to return to. But there was a time I thought, gosh, I'm only writing my parents' stories as they came to me. That's the first thing. That's one of my unpublished novels. But the other thing is, you know, I'm the mother of 30-something daughters. And same thing. I realized how little, when you're raising children, you realize how little you knew about your own parents. Earlier lives, my parents were raconteurs and they were writers. So I am the person who went through all their papers when they died. And there were a lot of them. Really a lot, but still, there's so much we don't know.
So Martha, for Duet for One, I'd asked if you had could prepare a couple of passages. So what have you chosen?
Yes, I would love to do that. So I'm going to read from the very, very opening of the book, which needs no introduction. And then I'm reading for the still from the first chapter, but a little bit farther along, where Adam, the son, who's at the graveside and also a professional violinist, comes back to his apartment and plays by himself, takes out his violin, plays by himself in his apartment, and thinks about his early love, Dara, who's the other protagonist in the book. So this is from the very beginning. Adele Pearl was dead, vanquished by ovarian cancer. Adam and Victor shivered at her graveside. Adam was 37 when his mother died. He was a violinist known for fluidity and grace. Victor was Adam's father, the surviving half of Pearl and Pearl, a world-renowned two-piano team and joint piano faculty at Philadelphia's Caldwell Institute of Music. Out of the corner of his eye, Adam watched Philip Hissell hurry downhill. Hissell tripped, then bent to pick up his fedora from the damp, muddy ground. Instinctively, Adam moved closer to his father, although Hissell was too far away to create a disturbance. For this small knot of mourners, time paused and music slept. For Victor, Adele's death was a black hole that sucked in music. For Adam, a numbness. This is the end of the first chapter, where Adam has returned to his apartment and has been playing his violin through the night, thinking of his mother. Adam had been playing for hours. Daylight was emerging, gray pushing away cobalt. He unscrewed his bow and slid a cotton handkerchief outside the stick and under the fingerboard to clear away rosin dust. Then he tenderly dressed his violin in its blue satin bag. He lay down on his bed, closed his eyes, and thought of Dara in the rear of the viola section. He could see her, even after all these years, her green eyes and thick chestnut braid, her small breasts outlined by a black cardigan. She had no interest in fashion. She wore faded brown corduroy pants that were several sizes too large. She arrived at rehearsals lugging a backpack stuffed with books, her hands smeared in blue ballpoint ink, with a pencil stuck through her braid for marking the music. For concerts, she wore a floor-length black skirt over a scoop-neck leotard, nothing like the frilly blouses other girls wore. The way she embraced her viola, left hand in classic Isaac Koroff position, bow arm circling downward, made Adam want to transform into a genie and hide inside it. He'd heard she'd married and was an English professor at Penn. What about the intervening years? Adam had been with other women, of course. Fine musicians, everyone. What about Patty? Adam was sinking to the bottom of love's ocean, layers of pressure bearing down. He may as well be 21 again. He loved Dara that much tonight. Or was it already tomorrow? He pictured Dara lying on his twin bed as she turned pages in a textbook while he practiced, saturating the room with sound. Her presence was reassuring, comforting. Dara, Adam said to no one in particular, my mother died.
So when you launch this book, you're going to have some music, some live music?
Yes, we're going to have we're going to have a violinist. I'm launching at Washington's biggest independent bookstore, Politics and Prose, which is in my neighborhood and very near and dear to my heart. We're going to have a violinist play a movement from one of the Bach partitas, which is something that is part of the narrative of the book. But I really care that the audience hear what's on the page, and you're a professional musician, so I'm sure you're familiar with everything I was talking about. But in the early 2000s, when I was beginning this book, I thought, oh, could I attach a CD to the book? But now we have access to all of this online, so it just feels really important that people hear it. And I don't have to tell you that many, 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 much of the reading audience will not be familiar with these pieces, I think. That would be my guess.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, they're certainly well-known works.
Yes.
So normally in this podcast, we have musical excerpts from usually from people's albums. So we won't be doing that today. But I thought what we could do is in the show notes, we could link some recordings that you love of some of the works featured in the novel. So if people want to click on those.
That's wonderful. So I'd be happy to get those to you.
Yeah. So just get them to me. And when I put it all together, people will be able to click.
Wonderful. I love that idea.
So to that idea, maybe do you want to speak to one or two of those pieces maybe you had played?
Finlandia is a book, a kind of iconic piece for music students by Jan Sibelius, the Finnish composer. And the first time that Dara, who is a young violist who ultimately becomes a English professor, she is Adam's love interest. And so the rehearsal, her first time playing in an orchestra of semi-professional caliber is with a rehearsal of Finlandia. And that is a very personal experience. You're sort of toward the back of the viola section, the trombones are in French horns are in your ear blasting out. And I wanted very much to give readers the feeling of being inside an ensemble, because I don't think we get that very much when we read, like what it means, where you are in the orchestra, what you can hear. And sometimes in the back of the viola section, you can't hear the first violins, which is very problematic because you're often trying to match with them. And just the fascination of what's coming out of your right ear, basically. So that section of the book is very autobiographical, and my first memory of playing Finlandia, which I played many, many times since.
Now, I'm curious about, like, obviously you've had such a full career. We still have to get into that as a lawyer, but, you know, did you have time to play the viola? Did you play it in amateur ensembles, or did that have to go by the wayside?
So I played, after I graduated college, I went to law school in Boston. I played all through law school. It was a very good antidote to the pressure of law school. Again, I think no classical music will be surprised by this. It turned out that every member of the MIT math department was like a really accomplished classical musician, not just okay. So I played with them every week, and it was so great. And they were very funny. They were like the prototypes of the absent-minded professors. Like one of them came, he was our first violinist. We played piano quartets, and the pianist was also a cellist. So we played string quartets. The guy who played first violin showed up one day and said, "Oh, I forgot it's my birthday," which is pretty hard to face. And my wife is having a party for me, so I can't stay. But it turned out he was some world famous. I mean, I'm not a math person, so I don't even understand what they were doing. But so that was wonderful and we performed at MIT from time to time. And then when I moved to Washington, D.C., same. I played in a semi-professional orchestra here, did a bunch of wedding gigs. Over time, and this is very associated with the death of my mother. My mother died very suddenly in 1999, and she had always been a champion of my writing, even though I was writing a lot of stuff for work, but I wasn't writing fiction. And something unleashed with her death that hasn't stopped. That's when I really started writing fiction. And I mean, I don't know the timing. Exactly. Eventually, I stopped playing. And part of that is because I could not keep up the practicing. I didn't have time. And it was so unsatisfying to play with being completely out of shape. And I felt like the minute that I started really thinking about fiction, what I want to do is get music on the page, which is impossible, but it's still what I want to do.
Yeah. And actually, just one more little question about this life as an amateur musician. When you were practicing and you had kids and all this, what was your routine to keep in any kind of shape? Would you play Bach? Like, what would you do?
Oh, well, so Max Aronoff, I always go back to him. He was a Sevchik guy. I don't know. Do people still play Sevchik?
Yeah.
Okay. It's torture for those of you non-musicians. It's like cod liver oil or your vitamins or something. I always go back to those early exercises of Kreutzer, Kaiser, basic scales and arpeggios. And as I said, he had these set of finger and bow exercises that were so meticulous. Like, and this is in the book, you know, he told me as soon as I started studying with him, I was in a 10th grade in America. I don't really know what that is in Canada. He said you have to practice 3 hours a day. I'm like, how am I going to ever practice 3 hours a day? But the thing is, by the time you went through all his machinations of every exercise, 3 hours was up. And you could have gone 6 hours. So it was not Bach. It was always those like grunt exercise, like whatever you do at the gym, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Three Muses, which I also really enjoyed. I actually have the ebook, so I can't hold it up.
Oh, can I? Maybe you mind if I hold it up?
Yeah.
Yes. So this is Three Muses. It's my marked up copy.
Really a very beautiful book. Difficult to read at times, both because of the Holocaust, which is part of the story, and also some of the harshness of the ballet world. You also danced ballet as a child.
I started very early on ballet, and I would say it was my first passion. But this is sometimes readers want to know this. It's less important to me. I had no talent, so no future there, which is really normal. Like very few people have a future in ballet, but I would say that was my first artistic love, and I was able to study at the School of the Pennsylvania Ballet, which was in Center City, Philadelphia, and I watched the rehearsals, and that was still, even now, is life-changing for me. I just loved watching ballet dancers rehearse. It was so interesting. So it's really imprinted on my psyche, I would say, but there's no way I would ever tell you I was a ballet dancer. I wasn't. I mean, I took classes and just loved it, but no talent, mm-hmm. to be really clear. And I loved the music. And it took me, we had live piano, and I was a little bit older when I realized exactly what I was hearing, which was like all of Chopin, Brahms, Haydn variations, like stuff that was really major classical music that we're just doing our grand bon mots to, and I didn't realize what it was. So I loved that musical aspect of it too.
Mm-hmm. So the character, Mr. Yankov, who mm-hmm. is, you know, there's exploitation, there's grooming, there's really mm-hmm. bad behavior. Did you see mm-hmm. any of this firsthand, or was it more just reading?
So two answers to that question. One is I'm of an age where I came of age as George Balanchine was developing his repertoire, and mm-hmm. Philadelphia was a trial city. So I saw a lot of that. I mean, I didn't see it in New York, but a lot of stuff came to Philadelphia first. So, and I read all of his reviews. So I knew what he was doing and followed his life. He's a shadow figure in the book. I didn't want to model the character of Yanikov on him exactly, but he was in the background. But no, where I saw it was in the music world and a lot of it, because I wasn't ever in the ballet world in any kind of professional capacity. So, but I was very familiar with the music world. And we're living in an era of Me Too, and Three Muses is set in the 1950s. I never considered toning it down or whitewashing it or anything, because it's just what it was in the 50s. I mean, there are any number of situations, I'm sure you're familiar with them too, where incredible abuse happened. And there's an ongoing, I'm sure you know this, an ongoing horror show with Laura St. John and the Curtis Institute of Music with Yasha Brodsky, who was the first violinist in the Curtis Stringer Quartet. I mean, I knew him. I didn't know anything about this, but I'm sorry to say it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, no, I'm very well aware of all that. Yeah. Well, at 14, you met Dr. Henri Parent, who was in this.
Yes.
One of the characters.
Yes. And he pronounced it. That was his name, but he pronounced it Henri Parent. He was a child analyst in Philadelphia. Sorry, this is always hard to talk about. He was a Holocaust survivor, and my impression from my own family and from him and other people I know is every Holocaust survivor story is monumental. So he had his own monumental Holocaust survival story. And he became a renowned child analyst in Philadelphia. So the protagonist in Three Muses named John is a survivor who survives by singing for the commandant as a child, and that commandant is the one who murdered his family. And John makes it to America and becomes a psychiatrist, but he has an extremely fraught relationship with music. I mean, it saved his life, but it also, he associates it with his family's murder. And Henry was the inspiration for John. I wouldn't say they're anything alike, but he inspired that character.
And you had a cousin Ellen as well.
Yes. And my mother's cousin Ellen also was the sole survivor. Well, no, that's more complicated, but she lost her family in the Holocaust. She came over with my mother's, their grandmother. She was my mother's first cousin in 1938, among the last people to get out of Germany. And she wrote up her childhood experiences. She had grown up in Mainz, Germany. She wrote up her childhood experiences and for her grandchildren and shared it with us. We were her second cousins. And it's a beautiful memoir that's at the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And the thing that struck me, I mean, we always knew she was German. We always knew she had lost her family, which is a very zippy, positive person. And the thing that struck me was the ordinariness of her life, and particularly for a lot of German Jews. There's a saying, you know, I never knew I was German. I never knew I was Jewish until Hitler came to power. Unfortunately, I have to say this for our American listeners. We are going through a really similar time here where people have said, I always thought I was American until Trump came to power. You know, we're in a terrible, terrible time in the United States right now. And so the ordinariness of life before Hitler came to power, and the non-German Jews were not particularly religious. And so her story really influenced me again as I got older and I got to know her as an adult. I realized, look what she's carrying around. I mean, it's like, it's unfathomable. It's unfathomable. We talked earlier in the podcast about the ballet dancer Katya falls in love with John, who's very traumatized by music. And so what does a ballerina need to do to do her work? She needs music. So Katya arranges a ballet with no music. And instead, the rhythm is set by the words to a Langston Hughes poem. And Langston Hughes is the narrator, in my book, of this ballet. So we're hearing this excerpt from Three Muses from John's perspective. He's in the audience watching her. John adjusted the bouquet of white roses in his lap. An expectant hush blanketed the hall. Langston Hughes, dressed in tails, walked to the microphone. A rain scream formed the backdrop, the sound not a drip, drip, not a driving shower, but the swish of light rain. Katya stepped out, quiet as breath, robed in a floor-length gray tunic. Her hair was loose, her arms bare. John could see her face, her eyes cast down, as she took her position center stage. He couldn't believe he knew her. Let the rain kiss you, the poet's voice mellifluous. Let the rain beat upon your head with silver liquid drops, undulating and rippling, flowing. Katya was lighter than silence, deeper than memory, her body fluid. Let the rain sing you a lullaby. Langston Hughes stood before the microphone, his words luxuriant. Underneath them, the rain rushed and sang. The rain makes still pools on the sidewalk. Over the past couple of weeks, John had experienced Katya's commitment to her art. He missed her with an ache that felt like sorrow. The rain makes running pools in the gutter. Katya streamed from one diagonal to another, flooding the stage with movement. The rain plays a little sleep song on our roof at night. And I love the rain. Katya rose and sank, leaping higher, tilting lower, a cascading waterfall. Let the rain. She floated and swirled, returning to her starting place like spume from a breaking wave. The poet paused. Sing you a lullaby. Langston Hughes stepped back from the microphone. John was overcome. He understood Katya's gift. She had danced a ballet without music, like an answer to grief. And that's from Three Muses.
Beautiful. Thanks for reading that.
Thank you.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Samantha Ege, the Euclid Quartet, Yale Strom, Ji-Yoon Kim, Emmanuel Abraham, and Anthony Brandt. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
And this book, Three Muses, which you published first, you won this Petrichor Prize, which is a very cool thing.
Thank you. I was really lucky. Now, as we've talked about, it took me a long time to get a novel published, and this was just a wonderful thing that happened to me. My publisher, Regal House, has a prize that comes with publication and an honorarium. So that's how this book got published. And again, it's a very important book to me, and I'm incredibly grateful that they gave me my start.
And after this was published and you were getting reactions from readers, finally, you know, getting this published, what was that like
for you? It was very surreal and very miraculous. And I'll be honest, I find it totally miraculous. I never thought I could be in the position that I'm in. I always wanted to write. I always wanted to publish a book. But there were many years of despair and frustration. I feel incredibly lucky, just incredibly, incredibly lucky.
So I was thinking the rejections that authors experience, it's similar to a lot of people in music too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm very close friends with a friend that I played with in college, plays in the National Symphony. And she's always talking about, you know, why didn't this person get into the National Symphony, or why didn't this person has had to have a freelance career their whole life, even though they could have played in any orchestra or whatever. It's so competitive. I mean, I don't have to tell you this. It's subjective, even though a lot of terrific, talented musicians get jobs. A lot don't, or have struggled toward it.
Yeah. So how did you deal with that? I'm sure you sent off the manuscripts and just didn't even get responses.
Yes. There are two answers to this question. One was abject despair. I will own that. Two was looking at myself and thinking, unlike music where I felt some real barriers, I'm not a good audition taker. My performing is fine, but I'm very bad at taking auditions. And where I felt limitations, I felt like no one would hold me back with writing, which is kind of a weird thing to say. But I never, like, I'd cry for a day and I'd get right back up and write the next thing. I was not defeated by it. And that seems so important and so meaningful that I just kept going. I'm like, what, you know, what is the definition of an idiot who keeps like banging her head against the wall, whatever that expression is, you know, I'm like, why am I doing this? But nothing stopped me. And I did recognize the significance of that. And over time, I finally learned the best advice, which I always give people, is try to get 100 rejections a year. That rejection is actually what's normal in writing land, and that any acceptance is a gift. And once I could reorient myself that way, I had a lot less despair. I realized, okay, let's get 100 rejections a year. That makes sense to me.
In terms of your book reviews, which we touched on, like you have bylines in all kinds of different publications. Do you think that helped?
Yes, it helped psychologically because it helped to be getting published and to be getting recognition in a different form. I'm still writing is writing, just as you're an improv musician, you play classical music. I feel like it's all connected. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but I would guess that you might feel the same way, that one form of writing feeds another form of writing. So it was tremendously, tremendously psychologically helpful. And it also feeds into my social justice work. I was so excited to have a platform to get really good writers out that people might not hear about otherwise.
And do you think, like you mentioned your mother died very suddenly. My mother also, like, she was diagnosed with a very serious illness when I was in my 20s, and it was her death was very difficult. It's taken me a while. So for me, I think it definitely gave me a sense of mortality a little younger.
First of all, I'm so sorry. It was just unfathomable. She was a physical Amazon and never sick a day in her life, and it was just like not in the cards. That's all I can say. She was the first of her generation on both sides of the family to die. And I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. She was always the one like swimming in ice cold water in Maine, and you know, she's physically intrepid. My parents were very close to each other, and so even like seeing my father by himself didn't make any sense. I mean, I was in my early 40s, like you think you would know better, but just the adjustment, I always say it was tectonic. It was a change in the entire view of the world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your career dedicated to social justice and, okay, you know, how you, you know, you went to law school and then how you got into this.
Thank you. So I went to law school because I love words, and that was a good choice for me. I went through different sort of traditional legal careers, legal jobs, and they were pretty unsatisfying. One was corporate law, which never was going to work. And then I worked for the government for some amount of time, and then a nonprofit. Finally, I realized, like, I don't think law is a great way to solve problems. And I began to look in the nonprofit world, and I was familiar with charitable foundations. In the United States, it's actually really an artifice of tax law that wealthy people can leave their wealth. And companies do this too, but wealthy families can leave their wealth in a pot. They're not taxed on it, but then that foundation is obligated to give money to the public. So I started looking around there, and I knew something about it because I had been involved with arts organizations that were supported by these. And I got really lucky. There was a family, not my family, another family, who was setting up such a foundation, and they hired me to run it. So they had chosen their program areas before they hired me, which were homelessness and what was then called disadvantaged or at-risk youth. But I was in charge of giving the money away and identifying who the money should go to. And because we were new and relatively small, I didn't feel that we could be effective unless we partnered effectively with other bigger organizations and collaborated. And the other wrinkle was that the family lived across the United States and a branch of them were in England. And they wanted to give widely. We didn't have very much money. So I had to figure out a strategy to do that where everybody, the family members were happy and we could be strategic. So over time, the program areas that we donated money to organizations. We always stayed in housing and homelessness, and then we got into criminal justice, the death penalty in particular, and the death penalty in about 1 second takes you to racial justice and the rest of criminal justice. You folks are a lot more civilized than we are south of the border. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible that the United States still has the death penalty, and we are out of sync with pretty much everybody in the world except like China and Iraq. I mean, we are not in good company here. So, I don't want to go on. It's not what your listeners are interested in. It's a travesty. So most of my career was spent in criminal justice, racial justice, and housing homelessness. Mm-hmm.
In terms of housing justice, what kind of solutions do you think are the best?
So we early on, my first chairman, whose family it is named Alan Morrison. He's a very well-known public interest lawyer, and he was hired by Ralph Nader to be sort of Nader's litigating arm in the early 70s. He had spent his life raising money to do litigation and also doing litigation. So he always kept me humble, like in terms of the difficulty that people have raising money. So it was his concept that we'd fund advocacy, and that, to be specific, that's instead of funding a soup kitchen, you fund work that will raise the federal budget to support subsidized housing. So an early victory was supporting a position in Washington, D.C. that could work in Congress. So I think the federal budget went up something like $600 million that year. So that's a $25,000 grant that really leverages it. Whereas it's not that people in soup kitchens don't need to eat, but it's how do you use small amounts of money to leverage. And so that's really was our strategy. And in the early 2000s, Alan retired from the board and turned it over to his cousin, who was much, much younger. And she's very entrepreneurial. And she said, well, why can't we raise money and increase our endowment? I said, because you can't. Nobody's going to want to give us money. But it turns out I had been in the process of developing a relationship with a Geneva-based foundation that had an office in London. And the London office did homelessness, and they were interested in widening their footprint in the United States. So we ended up raising millions of dollars from them that came to us for us to re-grant. So we were able to expand our work in making the connections between criminal justice and homelessness, our prison system. We live in a very punitive society, as the whole world is seeing that now. Some of us have known it for a while, but you get out of prison, you can't go into public housing. Because you have a criminal record, even though you've served your time. We have a convicted felon living in public housing right now in the White House. It's something that some of us have been talking about, since subsidized housing. It's not actually, all the things. Yeah. So there are states have some control over this, so we did some work at the state level. And then also there are all these employment barriers, because if you do a background check and find somebody has a criminal record, they can't get a job, which is crazy, because if you've served your time, there should be some rehabilitation. So that's a lot of the areas that we were working in. Also really, really, really important for white people in particular, I feel, to shine the light on racial justice. I mean, the criminal justice system in America is racist at every conceivable level, and the death penalty is the worst example of that. So we very mission driven to expose that and try to deal with it.
So reading novels is a good way for people to understand other people's perspectives. Mm-hmm. Off the top of your head, are there one or two books by Black authors that you would suggest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Ernest Gaines is a writer. It's Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying, about an innocent man, Black man being executed. I love that book. It's a classic in the genre. And I'm really enthusiastic, worship, love K.S.A. Lehman, who's a working American writer now, who is filled with this love and compassion for humanity and also a very harsh critic of white America. I reviewed his book Heavy for NPR, and I still think it's a really, really, really important book, and his essays are really important. I loved The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom, which is about Katrina and the unfairness and the inequities of housing in America. Those are all novels. Kiese's book Heavy is actually a memoir. And I loved Ta-Nehisi Coates' novel, Water Dancer, which is about Harriet Tubman and her work too on the Underground Railroad. And we can talk if you want me to offer you more for the program notes. I'd be happy to.
Sure. No, it's wonderful that off the top of your head, you were able to mention all that. You know, it's a few people had asked me to review albums, and I just don't do that. But what struck me for people that do that, there's this kind of need for listeners to make comparisons, like to know enough about the genre or the subgenre. Do you find that with literary criticism?
There's that. Yes. But can I ask you, why don't you do it? Is it because you don't want to be in a position of having to judge other musicians, or is it a time thing?
Let's say I retired from the orchestra and I had more time. I still wouldn't do it because I'd rather just do more podcast stuff, because this is what I enjoy doing.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Yeah. So I went to a panel early on in my critic's career where the three panelists said, we think the purpose of our work is to make people love books and read books. And I love that. I don't think it's anybody who writes a book gets applauded in my book and in my life, and I don't want to tear down a book. However, there are a lot of really bad books out there. So I want to signal to readers what they might or might not like about this book. And for example, I'm a reader who reads less for plot and more for the language and literary content, and I definitely recognize that's a minority view. A lot of people would rather read something for plot with a real page turner. So I try to signal that. And I also definitely do compare books to see if, you know, readers who like this might like that. And then I try to get in, I haven't been perfect about this, but I don't like the fact that, I mean, I noticed this in my like middle school. If you're a woman writer, you're only compared to women writers. If you're a black writer, you're only compared to other black writers. So I always try to mix it up because there's no reason that should be. There's just no reason that should be. So I always try to signal that these books are similar, even though the authors look different, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's great. I'm curious, in people making comparisons, let's say for Duet for One, are there other books that would people be interested in?
There's one that's my favorite, Feyre. I hope you've read it. It's called In Equal Music by Vikram Seth. It is the book that I wish I would have written. So he's Indian. I think he's British. I don't know that for sure, but that book absolutely blew my mind. And it came out around the time, I don't know the exact date. And it's nothing like anything else he's written. It's about a violinist. It's so beautiful. It is the book I wish I'd read. So that's my absolute number one choice. And then I got kind of really excited about, he's the editor of Gramophone. He's Canadian. Can you hold on a second? I'm going to go get the title of this book. It's called Us Conductors by Shawn Michaels. It won the Giller's Prize, I think in the early 2000s. I love that book. Really beautiful music book. And I'm going to be writing a piece about this for Lit Hub before my book comes out. I think there are a lot of books that don't do this well, so I do pay attention to the ones that do this well. I would be happy to give you some in the show notes. I have to think about that. I mean, I have written a couple of articles that I'd be happy to share with you, but Vikram Seth and Equal Music is top of the line, my favorite book of all time. I love that book.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a book I'm aware of, but I haven't read it, so I
I
guess I
know it
will.
was making the rounds in symphony among symphony players here
Yeah.
when it came out.
If you could spend a weekend with one character from each book, separate weekends.
Oh gosh. I would choose John from Three Muses, and I would choose Adam from I think I would choose Adam
Okay.
from Duet for One.
Okay.
Or Dara. I don't know. I might choose Dara. Wow, that's such a great question. Nobody asked me that, so I haven't thought about this. But Dara would be a really great conversationalist, I think.
Yeah, I would choose Dara, but I felt like she was a big part of you as well reading it, so
Yes and no. But
yeah.
she's very, Dara's very, very enthusiastic about her work, and I feel like we share that.
Yeah. I was reading your Substack blog, and this to me, something you posted after Thanksgiving, I thought, wow, what a community and family person. So can you share the story of going on the train and 50 people and
So I told you I'm from Philadelphia. My dad's entire extended family, well, Philadelphia was their port of entry in the United States. They all settled there, and it's still a hub, even though most of our elders are not with us. So we do Thanksgiving there every year. And since my dad died, he had the big house where we could host it. We've been renting an Airbnb, and this year we had a series of disasters. One of which was a dead chipmunk in the Airbnb when we arrived in SoFA. That should have been my signal that things were a problem. So I my sister, my younger sister and I organize it, and that every it's potluck. Everybody brings something. But Thanksgiving hat, you have to have a turkey. So there were two turkeys coming, one of which was not cooked. My sister Betsy brought a raw turkey. She needed to use the oven. It turns out there was no gas, heat, stove, hot water, anything. And it was basically one thing led to another. My brother-in-law knows a lot about, he installs gas fireplaces, so he immediately identified that there was a gas leak in the house. And then I'm like, oh my God, we're having 50 relatives over with friends. Anybody can bring anybody, so there's always people we don't know who show up. And we have no place to host this thing. So it's 10 p.m. and I called my cousin Carol, who lives about an hour north of Philly and has a very big house. I said, Carol, I don't really know how to ask this, but could you possibly host 50 people tomorrow? So she did, and amazingly, and my sister Betsy, who had the raw turkey, fortunately her daughter lives in Philadelphia, so she used her oven to cook the turkey. We didn't have a car, but my nephew's girlfriend lent us her car. Everybody came through, and Carol's like salt of the earth. And we had such a good time. And So I said to Carol's daughter-in-law, who was helping out, was this okay? Because honestly, we had no choice, 12 hours before this event. She said, yeah, but maybe Carol would like more than, could you give her a week next time? Notice instead of 6 hours. It worked. It was really, really fun. It's a really kind of major event. And Thanksgiving is really, I come from a Jewish family, but Thanksgiving is really, really the holiday in my family.
Yeah, it's a some Canadians have a version of something we call Canadian Thanksgiving in October, but it's not the same cultural thing it is for you guys because we're not the same country.
I really hope that you know that I know that. I'm very well aware of that. But it's the thing that we like about it. It's such an American holiday, and everybody I know, including recent immigrants, celebrates. And the thing that's really nice about it is there's no money involved. There's no gift giving or, shopping. It's just food. It's just like you eat. It's like it's so fun. I mean, I in my own family, Passover is a big holiday, which is coming up, and that's something I do with my children and extended next generation. And the same thing, anybody's welcome to come. But in my family of origin, it was really Thanksgiving.
So how does this, I'm just trying to wrap my head around 50 people eating dinner.
Well, a lot of people sit on the floor,
Okay.
and there's a lot of babies that there's definitely a lot of under fives who just run around the whole time. And then there's a lot of people sit on the floor. We've never been able to seat everybody,
Yeah.
but and then everybody brings something, and there's always too much food, which is very, very funny, if you think about it, because it's so many people. So, but I yes, their new baby's coming next year, so it's just great. It's we there's not one table, if that's what you're wondering. No
Oh,
way.
of course not. No, I was just curious because just the fact that you organize this says a lot to me about your values and where you put, because it can't be an easy thing,
No, I really, really appreciate that. And I always say, I mean, I have very good administrative skills. I will own that. But it's totally a group effort. Like, we couldn't do it, Like, I used to make the turkey, but I actually hate making turkeys. So Betsy and Connie, my two sisters on either side, make the turkeys. And then, Carol, cousin Carol does all the desserts. We have like our systems, but everybody contributes something. And my dad's family, I'm really, really lucky. They are absolutely extraordinary people. We all know it, and I'm knocking wood when I say this. I was not familiar with difficult extended families until I got to college. I didn't know it was a thing. Now it's like we know that that's the norm. Difficult extended families, the norm is that it's difficult. But I don't know. My dad's family are just extraordinary people. Yeah.
Let's so I mentioned I read this on Substack, and you're very involved in Substack, you have lots of followers. It's kind of, how do you deal with the overload? Like, there's so much good writing, but it's such a time suck. How do you balance that?
So this is so interesting. I have been sending out a weekly news. I've been sending out a newsletter for a very long time, and I got some advice before Three Muses came out that I should send it out weekly. And I thought, over my dead body, I'll never be able to do this. But now I have a whole different way that I look at it. So first of all, it's a little bit of a playground for me where I can test out ideas that I might not want to do a formal essay about. And as a writer, you're always hustling. You always have to pitch to get something placed, and I can just say what I want in my Substack. It sounds crazy, but I really like that, and it's now not such a time suck. It's sort of, I try to keep it short about what I'm thinking about, and I have pivoted since the election because I don't know what news gets out to your country. A lot of us are in complete despair and desperation, and people. I feel like one thing, my little contribution, my grain of sand that I can contribute is we have to hope. We have to fight this because despair is paralyzing and we cannot give in to this, even though lots of giant entities are giving into it. So I'm now devoting half of my Substack to political actions that you could take, reading that will support what you're doing, what's going on in your community. Like I feel, again, mission driven to do this. But so I would, if I might say, my Substack is Martha Ann Toll. I would love it if people joined us, not so much for the political stuff, but I let, I always like talk about what I'm reading. I like people to know sort of what's out there that they may not read in the Globe and Mail or the New York Times or whatever, stuff that's a little more off the beaten track. So it's, I feel like it's, yeah, it's not the time suck that it was, because I feel like I have a bit of a rhythm now.
Yeah, I didn't mean for you as a writer.
Yeah.
I meant in terms of the Substack community and, it strikes me like I'm trying to find my way with Substack. Like, I don't know how you get
I see
people to
what you're
notice
saying.
you, and it seems to
Yeah.
me like a that community.
The answer is I don't know. I was on a different platform before and transferred over to Substack. So I don't know the answer to that. I agree there's total overload, and it's like anything else in social media. How do you make your decisions? I mean, we recommend each other, and I know what I read, I know what I like, but you can't read everything. It'll make you cuckoo.
Yeah, that's why I was
It'll
curious.
make you really cuckoo.
Because I
Yeah.
looked at who you followed, and of course, it was a huge long list of really
But
great
some people,
people.
so some people, you can see what it is. It's classical music. And then there's some, to me, very, very important writers right now are keeping, who's sustaining me during this time period in the United States that I'm very reliant on for hard information, but also for spiritual uplift. So those are the two things. And then there's the reading ones, but the reading Substacks, but the, in terms of spiritual uplift and action-oriented Substacks, that's what I'm focused on right now during this absolute horror show that is south going on south of the border.
You've been involved with writers' groups and residencies over the years in terms of supporting. Do you have one in particular or an experience that sort of really nourished you?
Yes, well, I've been lucky enough to go to the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, which is in Virginia, which I love, and I particularly love that, and most of the ones I go to, I love that because they have visual artists, and I feel like visual artists, just as I feel about musicians, we feed each other's, and they also have composers, feed each other's interests in creativity and generative processes. And Virginia Center for the Creative Arts has a campus in southern France, and I've been there twice, and my French is fluent, so it's really fun to just like plug into the village there, and it's a beautiful place. It's a very, very special place. And I'm going to a residency that's new to me, but I think it's also a newish residency on Vashon Island off of Seattle. It's not that far. I mean, sort of across the border from Vancouver. And I'm really excited about that. That's totally new to me. It's going to be on a small island in the middle of the Puget Sound. And I'm doing that next autumn. I like it because even though I have my own study, a room of one's own, like Virginia Woolf talked about, getting out of your space geographically and interacting with other artists is always really, really inspiring.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks so much for this today, Martha. It was really an honor to meet you and have this conversation.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.